In this lecture of Unit 5, Component 2, we will talk about the two remaining types of basic clinical questions, harm and prognosis. We will first discuss the use of evidence-based medicine to assess questions about harm, or etiology. What causes a disease? Diseases may be caused by things in the air or water, bacteria, chemicals, radiation from the sun. Or they may also be caused by things that we do, such as a medical intervention that has a complication. The primary issue with assessing harm, or etiology, is not whether someone who gets exposed to some kind of agent gets ill, but rather if those who have that illness have had a higher rate or amount of exposure. For example, just because someone who uses a cell phone gets brain cancer does not necessarily mean that the cell phone causes brain cancer. In fact, we will look at that specific example. The ideal way to assess harm is to do a randomized controlled trial. If we think that a certain chemical causes cancer, the best thing to do would be to get a group of people together and randomize half of them to getting exposed to the chemical and half of them not getting exposed. But obviously that is unethical, so we cannot do that. We need other kinds of study designs that enable us to detect whether something causes harm. We have to go down to the next best level of evidence, which is observational studies. However, we need to be careful in how we interpret observational studies to ensure that they answer our questions. Here are some examples of questions that have come up in the news media about whether things cause harm. In the mid and early 1990s, there was the issue of whether silicone breast implants caused autoimmune diseases like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. It was definitely true that some women who had implants developed these diseases, which are commonly called connective tissue diseases, but they did not develop them at a higher rate than those who did not have breast implants. So silicone breast implants do not appear to cause these autoimmune diseases, despite many lawyers who believe to the contrary. Another question that came up in the 1990s was whether a number of anti-obesity drugs on the market at the time, like fenfluramine and phentermine, also known as Fen-Phen, caused problems like heart valve abnormalities. It turned out that those who used the drugs actually did develop certain heart abnormalities at a higher rate than those who did not have the abnormalities. When we are assessing studies of harm, we essentially have a hierarchy of evidence. A randomized controlled trial is the best method, and oftentimes we can use a randomized controlled trial to determine harm. The next best study is a cohort study, followed by a case control study, and a case series or an individual case report, the weakest form of evidence. In looking at these different kinds of studies, a randomized controlled trial would provide the best evidence for harm, but often it cannot be done, or it would be unethical to do so. Therefore, we have to use lesser forms of evidence. Another type of study is a cohort study. This is a prospective study where we take a group of patients who get exposed to something and follow them forward in time, but we do not randomize them. It turns out that cohort studies can be useful when poor outcomes are pretty rare, such that a huge sample size would be required. For example, upper gastrointestinal hemorrhage that occurs with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, like Motrin and Naproxen, turns out to be relatively rare. We see it in clinical practice because so many patients take these drugs, but the rate of bleeding from NSAID drugs is actually relatively low. In fact, it is difficult to do a clinical trial to detect that. So a cohort study can help us in a situation where these poor outcomes are rare. Of course, cohort studies are problematic when the groups are not really similar. For example, if we follow a cohort of people and we compare those who take the NSAID drugs and those who do not, they are obviously different people. Those who take the NSAID drugs are more likely to have ongoing medical problems, particularly those that require these drugs, so we do not get that benefit of randomization. Another type of study is a case control study. This is actually the most common form of observational study, and it is the most common type of study done to assess harm. There are times when we suspect that something is harmful, and we want to find out as quickly as possible. We cannot do a prospective study because it might take years to get results, so we look retrospectively. We identify cases of the disease that we think are caused by the harmful agent, and then we match them to controls, thus the name, case-control study. Then we look at the two groups, those who have the cases and those who are the controls, and we see if there is a different rate or amount of exposure. That, for example, enabled us to see that there was not a higher rate of use of breast implants in patients with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. Similar to cohort studies, case-control studies can be useful when the condition is rare. It can also be useful when the condition has a long development time. In fact, that is how it was determined that the drug DES, which was taken off the market in the 1950s, causes vaginal cancer in women. One of the problems with case-control studies is that they can create spurious associations. A case in point was a study that purported to detect a linkage between coffee consumption and pancreatic cancer. This study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, so it certainly carried the prestige of that journal. It turns out that those who ran the study used the wrong control group, which shows you that sometimes, even in the best of journals, bad science can get through. They used people who had other gastrointestinal diseases as the control subjects. Many gastrointestinal diseases have symptoms that are exacerbated by coffee, particularly gastroesophageal reflux. The people with these other diseases drink less coffee, so when you use them as a control group of cases versus those with pancreatic cancer, the people with pancreatic cancer drink more coffee, but the coffee is not the cause of their cancer. They drink more coffee because they can tolerate it better. In fact, when this study was repeated with an appropriate control group over a decade later, that association was disproven, and those of us who drink coffee could rest assured that we were not causing pancreatic cancer in ourselves. The lowest form of evidence is the case series, or even worse, the single case report. Of course, the reason why this is the lowest form of evidence is there is no comparison group. A case series can be used to generate a hypothesis that could then be tested with more rigorous study designs, but a case series or case report, in and of itself, is not considered to be high-quality evidence. A classic example of this is the drug Bendectin that came out in the 1980s as treatment for nausea in pregnancy. We should always be careful about giving any medication to pregnant women. But it turns out that Bendectin was probably unfairly singled out. In fact, the adverse publicity was so strong that it was taken off the market. Some women actually benefited. One of the ingredients of Bendectin was actually a vitamin. Bendectin was a combination of two agents, both of which were known to be effective, and neither of which had any harm. But because there was a case series of birth defects, Bendectin was taken off the market, depriving women with nausea from pregnancy an effective treatment. Let's make a few comments about prognosis. One of the most important things to know about prognosis is it is actually hard to do a good prognosis study because prognosis is the natural history of a disease, how the disease actually unfolds. In this day and age, there is very little in the history of a disease that is natural. In almost every disease, we intervene in some way, whether through diagnostic tests or treatments. Many studies actually end up measuring prognosis after some form of test or intervention. We may measure prognosis for a group of patients that have been diagnosed with a certain condition, or we may measure prognosis for a group of individuals who have been treated for something. When we start to do that, the differences between a prognosis study and a treatment study start to blur a little bit. The most common way that we measure prognosis is with a survival curve. This slide shows a survival curve from one type of cancer when it is diagnosed at different stages. Like many cancers, the worst stage of the cancer, the worse the prognosis. Those having stage 1 of this particular cancer have a good prognosis, while those having stage 4 have all died within 7 years. Here are some example studies. There have been several prognosis studies looking at children who were extremely preterm and were in neonatal intensive care units. There are a number of ethical and philosophical issues about how much intervention is desirable for these extremely small children, and a prognosis study gives us an indication of how they do, especially in this case, 6 years out. This one study followed a cohort of 241 children from the United Kingdom and Ireland who were born at 25 or fewer weeks gestation, extremely preterm. They were actually compared with classmates in their schools who were born at full term. The differences were substantial. 41% of the preterm children had serious impairment on a variety of cognitive tests, compared with 1.3% of their full-term classmates. Another study of prognosis was recently published on prostate cancer, particularly untreated early localized prostate cancer. This study focused on a group of men who were diagnosed between 1977 and 1984 and had a very nice long-term follow-up. Of course, in this day and age, many of them would have gone to surgery, but this gives us an indication of the natural history of the disease. About 17% of these men developed generalized disease, in other words, the cancer spread or metastasized to other areas, and 16% of these men died of the disease. This is another demonstration that many men who develop prostate cancer do not die from it, and it does not even spread outside their prostate.